Hi, everyone. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway for April 25th. Giving felons and ex-felons the right to vote has become a 2020 talking point, but there's a dark past.
I think that there are ripple effects, that there are entire communities who have a message sent to them by these policies that their voices don't matter.
We explore the history of disenfranchising incarcerated people and how the repercussions are felt today. Also on the show, health officials in Africa are rolling out the first ever malaria vaccine.
When we try to develop a malaria vaccine that will prevent malaria infection, in fact, what we're trying to do is do better than natural immunity, which is extremely difficult.
And we're talking about the divide between big budget and indie superhero movies. What do you look for in a superhero movie?
I would like to see more diversity.
I like them to be kind of funny.
With amazing special effects while being inspiring.
All right, let's do it, Takeaway listeners. Assemble. Imagine being an American citizen and not being allowed to vote. That's the reality for at least 1 million incarcerated men and women around the country. And the 2020 Democratic candidates have been weighing in.
Part of the punishment when you were convicted of a crime and you're incarcerated is you lose certain rights. You lose your freedom. It does not make sense to have an exception for the right to vote.
Once someone has paid their debt to society, I think that means they get a right to vote. While they're still incarcerated, I think it's a different question.
I think the right to vote is inherent to our democracy. Yes, even for terrible people.
So some disagreement there among the candidates about who can vote from prison. But in at least 10 states, thousands of formerly incarcerated people who have already served their time are still unable to vote. Restoring voting rights to people after they've been released from prison is an issue that Democrats are more united behind.
I have been long an advocate of making sure that the formerly incarcerated are not denied a right to vote, which is the case in so many states in our country.
When you are out, one of the things that needs to be restored is your right to vote.
The debate over felon disenfranchisement is playing out across the country, where a patchwork map of state laws mean things look very different in Maine than they do in Iowa or in Wisconsin. And some states are more draconian than others. Florida legislators, for example, are debating whether felons should only vote after they've paid any outstanding financial obligations, and we'll have more on that in just a minute. First, back to the beginning, and why we take a criminal's right to vote away in the first place.
So this policy dates way back to a now antiquated view of both democracy and criminal justice. The idea being if you commit a crime, then you are an outlaw, you're outcast from society, you're subject to civil death, and so you aren't allowed to participate in our democratic institutions. I don't think that's the way we view criminal justice or democracy anymore.
Sean Morales Doyle is counsel in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, specializing in voting rights.
But also specifically in a number of states, these policies exist in large part as a reaction to the 15th Amendment's mandate that Black people be allowed to vote. And states actually were coming up with ways of avoiding that and continuing to deny Black people the right to vote. And so they enacted laws that they knew would line up with a criminal justice system that disproportionately impacted people of color. And that continues to be the effect of many of these laws.
These laws, many of which are being fought today. I asked Sean to take us through the national landscape of felony disenfranchisement and why this topic is back front and center.
I think a couple of reasons. One of those is I think there's been some major change, perhaps the biggest change in decades on this issue in Florida just a couple months ago. And not only did Florida pass a constitutional amendment to restore voting rights to people who completed their sentence, but they did it with 64% of the vote. And so it showed that this is actually something that's politically popular across the political spectrum. But I do want to say also that while this is left to the states, the Constitution gives states primary jurisdiction to pass laws about elections, but actually there is room for the federal government to weigh in on this. And as part of the package that the House just passed, H.R. 1 earlier this session, was a piece called the Democracy Restoration Act, which has now been introduced by Senator Cardin as well, which would, on the Senate side as a standalone, which would restore voting rights to people who are no longer incarcerated in every state in the country for the purposes of federal elections as opposed to state elections, because Congress does have control over federal elections. And so I think there's a number of places where this has become central to the national conversation, both in terms of its political popularity, but also actually in the halls of Congress.
Let's talk about Florida. Mm-hmm. Specifically, you mentioned that this had passed, we actually covered it on the show, that this had passed by a large majority. And yet, this is still hitting a roadblock, despite the fact that Floridians want this bill to pass and they have passed it. What's the latest? Because now there are efforts to say, well, are we sure? Did we really want that? Tell us where things stand.
Yeah, so there are bills in both houses of the Florida legislature that have been introduced. Both of them would seriously diminish the impact of Amendment 4 by tinkering with the definition of completing all terms of your sentence. In Florida, the amendment says that if you've completed the terms of your sentence, then you have the right to vote. The House bill would make getting your rights back contingent on paying off all of the financial obligations that are heaped upon people in prison.
Pause right there. Mm-hmm. Why is it important that I pay anything in order to have the right to vote? Explain this connection to me.
Right. So in Florida especially, but in many states, when you are convicted of a felony or really of any crime, there are a lot of financial consequences that come along with that. There's restitution, there's court fees, sometimes inappropriately that you have to pay for your own appointed lawyer. And so the idea is that's part of your sentence. That's what the Florida legislature is pushing. The fact is that these bills would require you to pay those things off even after they no longer are part of your sentence, when they've been converted to civil obligations, when they're just like any other debt that you might owe, when a court has determined this no longer is part of your criminal sentence. They want to still make that part of what you have to do in order to get your voting rights back. Of course, I don't think there is a good reason why what you can pay and how much you have paid should ever be linked to your right to vote. I think as a country, we decided we wanted to move past that when we passed a constitutional amendment to do away with poll taxes.
Okay, so moving on from Florida, there are actually two states where people can vote from prison, and that would be Maine and Vermont. Tell us about that experience. Why is that so rare?
In part, as I mentioned before, the practice of felony disenfranchisement predates the United States. It goes way, way back. And so a number of states had this written into their constitution from the very beginning. Maine and Vermont didn't. Maine and Vermont's constitutions were different in a number of ways, but one of them was that they never, ever had a policy of felony disenfranchisement. So while in the rest of the country, you are seeing states move generally progress towards providing more voting rights and having less felony disenfranchisement over the course of the last few decades, at the very least, Maine and Vermont just were never there in the first place.
How active do we know how active folks are who are incarcerated, who are interested in voting? Do they actually use their right to vote?
All of the research about people voting who are formerly incarcerated or who have been convicted of felonies suggests that both registration and turnout rates are very, very low among that population.
Do we know why that is?
I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons why that is. One of those reasons, in a place like New York, say, where we have a bizarre policy where you can vote when you're on probation and not when you're on parole, although now the governor is restoring voting rights to people on parole through his pardon, is that people just don't know what the rule is. And so people are very confused. And even if you live in someone like Maine and Vermont, if you've heard about the fact that people with a record can't vote, then you think you can't vote and you're worried that you're going to do something wrong if you vote. And so we have a problem of de facto disenfranchisement. People just don't understand. But I also think that you're talking about a group of people who have been thoroughly disenchanted with the way the system works, who have been pushed to the outskirts and the margins of society in a million different ways, and who, quite frankly, often have way more on their minds and on their plates than getting out to the polls. They need to be worrying about shelter and employment and food. So I think there are a lot of things at play, but I think that there are ripple effects, that there are entire communities who have a message sent to them by these policies that their voices don't matter, that there's not a good reason to participate. And so I think in addition to the confusion, we see these policies extending to lower turnout in the community at large.
And yet there's a study that shows that voting, in fact, of restoring these votes has been proven to reduce recidivism rates among formerly incarcerated individuals. Is that right?
I think that there are a number of studies that have suggested that. There are also a lot of voices in the law enforcement and community supervision community who are very much in favor of restoring voting rights. Just recently in New York, the DA in Nassau County wrote a letter. One of the DAs in the city wrote a letter to the legislature encouraging them to restore voting rights to people on parole. The American Probation and Parole Association has come out in favor of this. I think people who are actively involved in trying to engage people in healthy reintegration into their communities are almost universally in favor of restoring voting rights, because it is the most pro-social behavior people can engage in, and it is a way for people to have a real stake in the community that they're returning to. And I think that is something we should all keep in mind, that it is actually in all of our interests to make sure that the people who are welcomed back to our communities feel like they have a stake and an interest in our democracy.
We talked about Maine, we talked about Vermont, we talked about Florida. What about, and I don't need you to give me the 50-state
sure.
list, but where, you know, is this indicative of a larger push to end this type of disenfranchisement beyond Florida, particularly for felons?
Yes. There has been, as I said, a trend over the last couple of decades of movement of progress on this issue across the country. That we went from, in the 60s, a situation where there were many states that permanently disenfranchised everybody who had been convicted of a felony. That is now only the case in, after Amendment 4 in Florida, in Iowa and Kentucky. There's 16 states and D.C. where everyone living in the community can vote. That includes Maine and Vermont, where you never lose your right. And we've seen progress there in New York with Governor Cuomo's action last year, in Louisiana legislation passed last year, which restored voting rights to a lot of people on probation and parole. We've seen bills introduced in more than a dozen states, perhaps more than 20 states this year, and progress made in a number of states towards passage. I think that we are seeing a national trend, and I think Florida sort of was the most obvious and impactful example of that in terms of the number of people impacted, but it also served as a reminder to a lot of other states that this is actually something that is politically viable and that people are really interested in, that voters are enthusiastic about.
Florida is also fighting it, and Florida is a key state in every election. We know, as we've mentioned, there's a big one coming up in 2020. Is that factoring into the equation so far in terms of whether states, given the power that that state could have in a general election, whether that state may or may not try to move these forward?
Yes, I do think that there are people in Florida and elsewhere who are motivated by party politics when deciding who should have the right to vote and who should not. I think we should all be able to agree that who will win an election should not be what determines who we give the right to vote to, that we should not be making our decisions about who has the right to vote based on what impact we think that is going to have on the outcome of any given election. But yes, I do think that's something people take into account, and I think it's a shame. I mean— Amendment 4 received more than a million votes than any candidate in Florida did. The politicians in Florida should be getting the message loud and clear from their constituents that no matter where they are on this party spectrum, they don't think it's proper or appropriate to be denying all these people the right to vote. And I hope that that is the message that will drive this conversation moving forward rather than some, you know, consideration of party politics and who's going to win the next presidential election.
We also have another thing happening in 2020, which is a little thing called the census, which is having its own political brouhaha, if you will. But within this census, prisoners are counted, or incarcerated individuals are counted. But how are they counted?
So there's sort of two questions there. There's the question of how the census counts them, and then there's the question of how the states take them into account when redistricting. My understanding is that the census counts them in the place where they are incarcerated. For most purposes, that's not going to have a huge impact. Most people are incarcerated in the state where they live, right? It's only federal prisoners who are going to end up incarcerated somewhere else, and that's a small percentage. But for redistricting purposes, what's important is how states take those census results and use them in deciding where to draw lines for election districts. And in many, many states, they count people in the place where they are incarcerated, which usually, like in New York, most people are not incarcerated in New York City. If they're from New York City, they end up getting incarcerated upstate somewhere. So that's going to skew where it looks like people live for purposes of determining the political power of various parts of the state. A few states have passed legislation to end what people often refer to as prison gerrymandering. And in fact, yesterday, the state of Washington, the governor signed a bill to do just that and to start counting people in the place where they came from, at their last address before incarceration, so that political power is distributed in accordance with where people live and not where they are temporarily incarcerated.
And just wrapping up here, how do issues around felon voting rights tend to poll with voters, regardless of party affiliation? Is Florida sort of a beacon in this space? Or was that a bipartisan decision, or was that leaning towards one side or the other?
Anything that gets more than 50% of the vote in Florida is a bipartisan result. Polling both before Amendment 4 and since Amendment 4 continues to show that there is support for this across party lines. There was just a poll not too long ago in Kentucky, which is one of the remaining states with permanent disenfranchisement, that showed that yet again. I mean, I think it depends on exactly the precise contours of the policy that you're polling on and what you're asking people to weigh in on. But generally, the concept of restoring voting rights to people who are living in their community, I think, is something that people in both the Democratic and Republican and non-party affiliated people are in favor of. And polling has shown that time and time again. And I think Florida just proved that in a way that people really can believe.
Sean Morales Doyle is counsel in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, and he specializes in voting rights. Thank you so much, Sean.
Thank you.
Every 2 minutes, a child dies from malaria. That's according to the World Health Organization. Now, the first ever vaccine has been approved, and it could help save thousands of lives in sub-Saharan Africa, where malaria is most prevalent. But it's still far from a silver bullet against a disease that's particularly hard to combat. Miriam Laufer is a professor of pediatrics at the Center for Vaccine Development and Global Health at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Dr. Laufer, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much.
So first off, let's talk about the scope. We said every 2 minutes, there is a child who passes from a malaria infection. How contagious is this, and who is most at risk for this disease?
So as you mentioned, about 500,000 people die of malaria every year. That group is almost exclusively children under the age of 5 in sub-Saharan Africa. So there used to be malaria in most parts of the world, and in many places it's been eliminated. In some places the burden has gone down to the point where it's barely a problem. But in sub-Saharan Africa, young children continue to die at incredibly high rates as a result of malaria infection. It is spread by the bite of an Anopheles mosquito, a particular kind of mosquito. And when it has the infection with the parasite, when it takes a blood meal from a person, when it bites a person, it can spread malaria that way.
How effective do you expect the vaccine will be at combating malaria, doctor?
Well, that is the million-dollar question. What we've seen from very well-controlled, carefully performed clinical trials is that the vaccine decreases the burden of malaria by about one-third. So what exactly that will mean in terms of the public health impact is exactly the purpose of this new implementation study. So it doesn't mean that one-third of children will never get malaria. What it means is that overall there'll be about one-third less infections. So does that mean there'll be one-third less deaths? If that's the case, then the malaria vaccine would be very beneficial.
Is that why it's being hailed as a breakthrough?
It's being hailed as a breakthrough because, you know, malaria has been around since before human beings existed. And to this day, we have not had a malaria vaccine that's been introduced on a large scale that has had any kind of efficacy. So there's two ways to look at this. One is, malaria is a huge burden of infectious diseases in sub-Saharan Africa. So if we have an intervention that will decrease that burden even by a proportion that we would like to see higher, but even 30%, it may have a huge benefit. And it presents the possibility that future, perhaps improved vaccines will have a role in the immunization schedule. On the other hand, it certainly is not a vaccine where anyone thinks this is an adequate enough efficacy to do anything like eliminate malaria.
I'm speaking with Dr. Miriam Laufer, a malaria expert at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Doctor, you worked for years in Malawi. What have been the challenges that you've seen in combating malaria to this point?
So the story of malaria in Malawi is very similar to many other of the high burden areas where we are seeing a decrease in the amount of malaria in the richer areas, in urban settings, where for a variety of both social and biological reasons, it's a little bit easier to control malaria. But what we see in Malawi and in many other places is that the more marginalized populations, rural households, people in very low socioeconomic status who have poor access to resources, there we're seeing malaria persist and in some cases even increase.
The vaccine has been in the works for 30 years. I am not a doctor, nor am I a scientist, so this question might seem basic, but why has it taken so long?
So malaria is a very complicated organism. So it has really evolved since before the existence of humans, since our, you know, our ancestors, to evade our immune responses. For example, if you get measles once, you never get measles again. So when we developed a measles vaccine, all we needed to do was to, I mean, and I don't mean to belittle this, but was to simulate what happens in natural infection. In contrast with malaria, children who get exposed to malaria repeatedly get malaria over and over and over again. So even natural immunity is not perfect. You might get immunity to severe disease. So after children reach 5 or 6 years of age, they've developed immunity to severe disease, and they're less likely to get very sick with malaria. But they still get malaria infections. So when we try to develop a malaria vaccine that will prevent malaria infection, in fact, what we're trying to do is do better than natural immunity, which is extremely difficult.
Doctor, what's a measure of success in the implementation of this for you? We know that in Malawi, children are being immunized against malaria. Kenya and Ghana are going to soon follow. How will you measure success here?
So there are three important factors that are being assessed in this implementation study, and I think that they are the right ones to measure. The first is the impact on mortality, on childhood deaths. So if we want to take, if we want to understand the real public health impact of a vaccine against malaria, that is an infection that is so ubiquitous, we want to look at the most extreme cases, really, and see if we can have an impact on those. So one of the important things is to look at the impact on death. And then the other two things they're trying to look at are whether it's feasible to introduce this vaccine. So this vaccine is on a schedule that's different from all other vaccines. And so we have to see if the public health infrastructure, the vaccine programs, can handle additional visits to the health centers and all these additional vaccines. Are parents willing to bring their children for these extra vaccines? And finally, ensuring that it's a safe intervention when it's used in hundreds of thousands of children.
Dr. Marian Laufer with the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Doctor, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Hey, you, podcast person, Amy Walter here, host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Every week, I'll take you beyond the headlines for a deeper understanding of how Washington works, who's pulling the levers of power, and how it all impacts you. I hope you'll check it out. Just search for Politics with Amy Walter in your podcast app and subscribe. Happy listening.
I'm here to talk to you about the Avenger Initiative.
Hey, man, we're about to jump on that ginormous spaceship. You want to come?
Anybody ever tell you you're a little paranoid?
Not to my face. Why? Did you hear something?
I'm getting revenge. You're getting revenge.
Seriously? You gotta clean up your room. It's a complete mess.
I am Groot.
I am Iron Man.
Everyone up here versus everyone down there.
This is your legacy.
Did he freeze?
Like an antelope in headlights.
Are you finished?
Puny God.
Back here on The Takeaway, I'm Tanzina Vega. Avengers Endgame, the last chapter in Marvel's movie universe, is making its way into theaters this weekend. Its marketing budget, somewhere in the $200 million range, and its runtime, just over 3 hours. 3 hours? I don't even remember the last time I saw a movie that was 3 hours long, but I digress.
Even if there's a small chance that we can undo this, I mean, we owe it to everyone who's not in this room to try.
If we do this, how do we know it's going to end any differently than it did before?
Because before you didn't have me.
Hey, new girl, everybody in this room is about that superhero life. And if you don't mind my asking, where the hell have you been all this time?
There are a lot of other planets in the universe. And unfortunately, they didn't have you guys.
The latest Avengers film is on track to gross more than $900 million globally in its opening weekend. But while Marvel's heroes continue to soar at the box office, a recent indie superhero movie hasn't gained as much traction.
Didn't you ever wonder if our abilities meant something? Like we could really do something.
We're not superheroes, Lila. We're just trying to get by.
But what if there's more?
Trust me, there's not.
But what if there is and you just can't see it?
That was Gugu Mbatha-Raw and Sanaya Sidney in a scene from Fast Color, directed by Julia Hart. The movie stars Mbatha-Raw as Ruth, a woman who has supernatural powers, who returns home to her family while hiding out from the authorities chasing her. Since opening in limited release last weekend, Fast Color has struggled to find much of an audience. And that suggests that the future might be bleak for other low-budget superhero movies.
Dread it. Run from it. Destiny arrives all the same.
With me is Valerie Complex, a freelance writer covering cinema, and Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway. Great to have you both back on the show.
Hi, Tanzina.
All right, let's start with the big movie this weekend, Avengers Endgame. It's the 22nd Marvel movie. No wonder why I have trouble keeping up with all these films. For anyone who missed some of the 21st prior movies, what was it all about, Rafer?
Well, it's all about saving the world, pretty much. You know, what else is there to do if you're a superhero?
Try 21 times, and we're going to get it on the 22nd.
There's going to be a supervillain. He's going to come down, try to take over the world. In the case of the Avengers, the latest ones, it's take over the entire universe.
Oh, wow. Okay,
so that's things are getting big.
Now, Valerie, Marvel, as we've talked about on the show, has been slow to make movies about heroes who aren't white guys, right? How much do some of the heroes from Captain Marvel and Black Panther factor into this film?
A little bit.
Because this film is
really about the OGs, as you say, the originals. The original six or seven. Thor, Captain America, Black Widow, the Hulk, Iron Man, and Hawkeye. Mm-hmm. So it's really about the core and focuses on that.
So given that, large blockbuster films looking at superheroes seem to get all the attention. Let's pivot for a second to the other film I mentioned at the top, Fast Color. Valerie, you saw this film. What did you think about it?
I really liked Fast Color. It's not a perfect film, but I think overall it's a worth it movie, one to watch, especially if you're looking for something that doesn't have a $100 million plus budget and where the focus is really the characters and not their powers and what they can do. But it's a family drama about people with powers.
Rafer, in terms of representation in indie space and indie films, particularly when it comes to superheroes, how good of a job is being done?
In indie films, I'm not sure you'd see anything that's a heck of a lot better, necessarily. You know, I think the superhero genre in general is something that indie filmmakers tend to stay away from because it demands such an astronomical budget. And you look at something like Fast Color, and you're clearly looking at somebody who's using what's at hand. You know, they're using existing people's homes and you know, found locations. You know, I don't know what the budget is on that, but I would guess it's pretty low. Less than the marketing budget of the Avengers film.
For the film, right.
Right.
And even given that, Fast Color has not done so well in the box office, Valerie. I'm wondering, is there an audience for indie superhero movies like this, or can you see some crossover between the folks who are maybe going to see Marvel, DC films, and the folks who are coming to see this, or are they just totally different audiences?
Well, I think that the indie market has always been a tough one to crack in terms of like getting audience participation and viewership and things like that. And when you have something so niche as Fast Color, I think, you know, there's something missing from the mainstream that would sort of bring those fans over to the indie scene. We need more female superheroes. We need more superheroes of color, and we need more female superheroes of color. Because I think once you have that in the big budget, that might actually give people the interest to want to see something a little bit more on the indie side. The marketing for Fast Color they didn't have a huge budget. And a lot of people are now seeing Fast Color because of word of mouth, not necessarily because of the marketing. And I just think that there's a lot of different factors. I think race plays a factor. Gender plays a factor. There's just a lot of factors working against the film. And it's unfortunate because when you smack it in between two blockbusters, we just had Shazam, and then now we have Endgame. Anything that comes out in between that time is going to get swallowed up.
And given the fact that there is an audience, I think, for superhero movies led by women of color, I mean, are there any lessons that can be learned from Fast Color?
It's important to remind these studios that dollars matter and people of color do go to the movies. And that's why I think a lot of it has to do with some form of bias, you know, or discrimination, because there's money to be made, but they're not going after it. So it was really the problem.
I have an idea. How about a movie, if you're hearing me, Marvel, about the Dora Milaje only, right, from Black Panther?
People have been crying out. They've been begging for a film about, like, Storm from the X-Men.
Yeah,
like,
what about Storm?
This is, like, the stuff that, like, Fast Color is a type of stuff that people have been begging for because it's an original concept. Women of color are in charge. People just don't know about it. Like, I've had to retweet, you know, and spread my review far and wide for people to be like, oh, that came out? Okay, I'll go check it out.
You're nodding, Rafer. You agree?
I think with a movie like this, there's just probably only so much you can do. Julia Hart's husband is Jordan Horowitz, who co-wrote the script with her, mm-hmm. I think, and he is the producer of La La Land. No slouch in the producing business, I'll just say. And here's his own baby of a movie.
It's struggling.
You know. I just think, and you see this all the time, you know, with A-list stars. I get emails all the time about movies with two or three A-list stars that are coming out on DVD. And it's because, you know, whoever's putting these things out doesn't have the faith that these movies can make it against something like a Marvel Endgame or a Shazam.
Valerie Complex is a freelance writer covering cinema, and Rafer Guzman is film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway, and we appreciate you both so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, this is Kat from St. Louis, Missouri. I would like to see more diversity and lead character-driven movies like Black Panther, more female-driven movies like Wonder Woman and Captain Marvel, and more representation like those two characters who weren't presented as over-sexualized eye candy.
Hi, this is Laska, and I'm calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan. In superheroes, I look for oddness, quirkiness, darkness, meditation on the human condition, conflicted heroes and heroines, realism.
Hello, this is Victoria calling from Minneapolis. I'd like to see an environmental hero that communicates a vision for the future that is hopeful and offers real science and effective action. Make it fun, dramatic, with amazing special effects while being inspiring.
Hi, this is Susanna calling from Burien. I'd like to see way more movies where the main superhero is an ethnicity other than Caucasian looking. There hasn't yet been a Filipino-American Marvel main superhero or many other ethnicities. I would love to see more African-American superhero main characters as well. Basically an equal percentage of women and way more diverse ethnicities playing the main characters.
Well, hey there. This is Fred Brinkley from Waxhaw, North Carolina. And in a superhero movie, I like them to be kind of funny. If it doesn't have a little humor in there, it just gets boring.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.